This is Charlotte Frascona. Today is Monday, October 24th.
I'm interviewing Herb Heineman as part of the oral history for the Industrial Relations Research Institute. Herb, can you please talk a little bit about your educational and professional background?
Sure. I went to a small liberal arts school for men in Indiana called Wabash College, and got a degree with a joint major in economics and psychology, and then came directly from there to the University of Wisconsin to the Industrial Relations Research Institute, and received a NDEA 4 fellowship, which was a very lucrative fellowship that was being granted at that time throughout the country, and entered the IR program in 1966, and then got my master's degree in 1968, and my PhD in 1970. During that time, I was also working on a part-time basis for what was called Dayton's, which is a retailing organization in Minneapolis that subsequently became the Dayton Hudson Corporation, and later on recently changed to become the Target Corporation. In those working experiences, both during the year and during the summer, I was employed in doing human resources research for the company. After I received my PhD, I joined the faculty in the School of Business at the University of Wisconsin, and in the Management and Human Resources Department, and basically spent my whole career there. I retired formally in 2001, but then have continued to work on a part-time basis with some people in the School of Education in a variety of areas having to do with issues involving teacher quality. Even though I was here at Madison the whole time, I also was on leave several times, twice to Ohio State, once to the University of Washington, and once at the University of Florida. So in a nutshell, that's what happened to me.
And with an undergrad background in psych and econ, how did you find out about IR? What brought you to Wisconsin's master's program and then PhD program?
I found out about IR because my father was a professor of industrial relations at the University of Minnesota, and so I had a bit of an inkling what IR was all about.
You grew up with it.
I grew up with it, and I also had a couple of very influential professors at Wabash College who were acquainted with IR and thought that that would be an ideal sort of program for me, who had a sort of combined interest in both economics and psychology, and so they were both very helpful in sort of steering me in the IR direction as well. And so my senior year at Wabash, then I simply decided to apply to various IR programs, including Wisconsin, and was accepted at Wisconsin, and as I say, offered this very nice fellowship also.
And what was ND?
NDEA, that stood for National Defense Education Act. That was federal fellowship money that had been passed because there was such a shortage of PhDs in many areas throughout the country that they figured they needed federal dollars to sort of entice people to enter into various specialty areas, including industrial relations.
And after you got your PhD and were hired by the business school, what was the nature of your association with the Institute?
I continued a very close association with the Institute for my whole career. I was basically a participating faculty member in the Institute. I served on various committees, the Executive Committee, and especially the Admissions Committee for many years. And I guided both master's and doctoral students. And then in, I believe it was 2000-2001, I served as the acting director for a year.
So you were affiliated with the program roughly from 66 through 2001, which is a very long span. How did how did the Institute change in over the course of those decades?
When I came, the Institute was flush with money, and most of that was money from people in economics, in particular Jerry Summers and Glenn Kane, and they used that money to basically infuse the IR program with substantial support for both faculty and students. And if I remember correctly, I think just about everybody who came into the program had some kind of financial support. And so it was a very robust program then. It was also large, and it had a mixture of probably more PhDs than master's students, although it might have been about 50-50. It was a very close-knit group. We all sort of studied together, lived reasonably close to campus, and it was a marvelous time. It was kind of the best as it could be. I think over time, the money began to dry up. Our ability to support students continued to wither away. Many of the faculty who were very instrumental in the program and committed to the program retired, left, or died. And I don't think we ever quite regained the momentum that we had at the time I entered the program. And I think that's very unfortunate, obviously, but I think that realistically, that was sort of bound to happen. Things just changed, and it was very difficult for us to recapture what we had had back then.
The money that you mentioned, was this university money or grant money?
It was mostly grant money from the Department of Labor to Jerry Summers and others. As I said, we were really blessed with substantial amounts of money that had been given to Jerry over the years.
So he was good at bringing in. He was good at bringing in grants.
Yes, yes. I used that. There, people used to joke about Jerry having a wheelbarrow and he'd just take it out to Washington.
They'd fill it up.
Fill it up, yeah.
So the college itself never put a lot of money into the program.
No, they did not. They put in some money, but to my knowledge, we never had any funded faculty positions full-time, although the college did support various people on a part-time basis, mostly people in business and in economics. But over time, even that level of support began to wither.
I have a question about your time as a grad student. You said you were here roughly from 1966 to 1970.
Mm-hmm.
That was a pretty volatile time on this campus.
Oh, indeed it was.
What was going on in the IR program?
Well, the IR program was a very socially aware group of students, a very activist group of students, and they were active both in the anti-war protests as well as in the formation of the Teaching Assistants Association. And between the two, it was a very exciting time to be a member of the IR program.
Was it a cohesive group, or were there real splits in terms of the anti-war folks and the other folks, or the pro-TAA and the anti-TAA?
Yeah, in terms of the war, I think most people were in one degree or another sort of anti-war. Some were more agnostic than others, probably. In terms of the Teaching Assistants Association, again, I think most people were in varying degrees supportive of the attempt of the students to form the TAA. And others some students were more agnostic about that as well. I think in the case of the TAA, one of the most interesting tidbits about all of that is that two of the prime actors in the whole formation and early stages of the TAA were on the opposite sides of the issue. Jim Marchetti was the one of the original founders of the TAA and very active in support of it. And Jim was in the PhD program. He and I believe entered the same year. A person named Neil Buckley was exactly opposed to Jim, and in fact Neil became the bargainer for the university to bargain the first contract between the university and the TAA. Mm-hmm. And Neil also entered the program the same year I did. So here we were, the three of us, all entering the program at the same time, and in the case of Neil and Jim, taking very divergent paths.
Do you think that the fact that the TAA had its seeds in the IR program bears any relationship to the feeling of LNS about IR? Has IR kind of been a thorn in the college's side?
I don't think anybody in LNS likes to say that, but I think probably in fact that has been the perception over the years. And you know, if you think about LNS from an administrator's perspective, they surely have been at a minimum inconvenienced by the existence of the TAA, and some would argue it's been a lot more than inconvenience.
Costly,
disruptive, restricting academic freedom of faculty, and so on. So, yeah, I think there's no question that most people in letters and science, at least on the administration, did not see the TAA in a very favorable light.
When the Institute was at its heyday, flush with money, a large, close-knit group, lots of faculty involvement, what were its strengths? What could it do that students or faculty could not do in a regular mainline department?
Well, the abiding strength of the Institute was its interdisciplinary nature, and all of the students and the faculty were very firmly committed to the interdisciplinary nature of the Institute. From a student's point of view, we were allowed considerable discretion in forming our own program across departmental lines and across even college lines. And so we had this tremendous opportunity to sort of define and create who we are as we went along in terms of our studies. I think another characteristic of the Institute that was very important was the emphasis on research, both for faculty and for students. We had very rigorous research and statistics requirements that we were all required to meet, regardless of our independent substantive interests, and that too served to define the Institute, particularly at the PhD level, and the large number of grads from the program who went on to very successful academic careers. They got just tremendous training in research and statistics here, and probably would not have been able to duplicate that at any other program that I remember in the United States.
Even though your dad teaches it.
Even including Minnesota, yeah.
What could you do as a IR faculty or IR affiliated faculty member that you could not just do here in the Department of Management?
I was pretty free to roam in both the Management Human Resource Department and IR. I think for almost all of the people in our department and in others around the campus, the draw for IR was our commitment to IR as our field, and secondly, our attraction to the really high-quality students that we were able to work with in the IR program.
Well, I'm wondering, given that, given the attraction to the field and the interdisciplinary connections with other faculty and the caliber of the students, why did faculty drift away from the Institute? I mean, not you,
yeah,
but other faculty.
Well, I think part of it was that some of the faculty over time retired or died, and then were not replaced with like kinds of people, particularly in the Department of Economics. Many of the people who were basically institutional economists, when they left, they simply were not replaced, and so we saw quite a withering of support from economics for the industrial relations program.
So that was a conscious choice on the part of the econ department to hire people who were interested in other kinds of things.
Absolutely. And you know, they're very clear about that was how they chose to reshape the economics department. I think another thing that happened is that faculty and other is newly replaced faculty came on board, they became more caught up in their own department, which was their natural home, and just didn't quite ever have the opportunity or the interest in getting as involved in the Institute as maintaining an affiliation and an identification with their home department, and I think in the long run that hurt as well.
Have tenure requirements grown more stringent so that where in the past somebody could write a few articles to get tenure, now people have to have a couple of books, and so there's just a greater demand on assistant professors to produce, and they don't have time for a place like IR?
I think that's a good point, and I guess I would agree with that. I think for most of the faculty who were involved in the IR program, they were able to hitchhike on the IR program to be productive in ways that were valued by the university, and so we didn't really pay any particular price for participation, whereas I think now faculty, or in say the last 10 years, faculty really would have paid more of a price simply because they couldn't, the time requirements would just eat away at time that they could have more productively spent doing things that would have been rewarded, including granting tenure.
So the IR program might have to wait till somebody becomes an associate professor to get buy-in from that person, and by then perhaps he or she is so entrenched in his or her own department that it's just not likely that person's going to come along and devote a lot of time to IR.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. And I also think that the sort of the subject areas within IR that were viewed as interesting and important sort of shifted, and that collective bargaining in particular became less of an emphasis. And both economics and the law school had been big supporters of that area of study. And as those faculty in economics and law left, they didn't get replaced with like people with an emphasis in collective bargaining. And so that sort of diminish the participation of some people in the Institute as well.
And also outside of this particular institution, things are changing in the U.S. There are fewer unions in the private sector.
Right.
More public sector unions, more global issues to pay attention to, less big labor versus big management in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think we always like to think of IR in the broadest terms as the study of the employment relationship. But a big component of that, at the time I became a member of the Institute, was the study of collective bargaining, and that slowly eroded over time as, in fact, the labor movement became less of a force economically and politically in this country.
Given the fact that things changed in the U.S. and also things changed so much on this campus, why not just let the Institute go? Why was there this big push to try and save it in the past, say, 5 or 6 years?
I think for many of us, we saw a sort of an abiding value in having an interdisciplinary program focused around areas having to do with the employment relationship, and that was a unique focus that you simply could not replicate in any other department. Nor was the feeling that we would want to try to replicate that. So, for example, it was oftentimes discussed about bringing the IR program into like the business school. And while there were some merits to that argument, we basically felt that having an interdisciplinary standalone program was much to be preferred, and that as soon as it became a member of a particular department, be it business or whatever, that would compromise the sort of the independence of the program and our ability to attract a wide variety of students, which historically the Institute had always been able to do. I think for all of the people who participated in the Institute as faculty, we just really treasure the breadth of students that we had, sort of the diversity of students in so many different ways, that we just didn't see that having the Institute affiliated somewhere else would allow that to continue.
How is it that the IR program at Minnesota, Ohio State, Cornell, Illinois, they've all been able to thrive and the IRI has not? What do you think accounts for the gradual decline of the Institute and ultimately its demise?
The three schools that you mentioned all have full-time IR faculty tenured in those programs, and so unlike the Wisconsin model, they had a nucleus of tenured faculty and the budget commitment that went along with that, and I think that makes a tremendous difference, particularly in times of scarce resources. It's much easier to whittle away at less visible programs such as industrial relations when it does not have a full-time faculty associated with it. In fact, that's what happened to our budget over time. It just sort of, it got chipped at and chipped away at, and sooner or later we were down to relatively small budget numbers. I think another thing is that in the programs you mentioned and in others, because they had a full-time faculty, they had full-time programs, they had outreach programs and still do, that allowed them to generate tremendous external support for what they were doing. And while Wisconsin had some external support, particularly from the labor movement, I don't think we had anywhere near the support that these other programs have been able to generate over the years. Support particularly from industry, we simply never sought it nor had it. I think another difference is that in those programs, They had not only full-time faculty, but they had full-time leaders who were ensconced within the program itself. They didn't have a dual loyalty to another department or another function, and so they could devote full-time to a leadership role. Whereas within the Institute, we had leaders, but they were always part-time leaders, and they had very busy agendas, and they had responsibilities to meet outside of industrial relations if they wanted to continue to be successful as a faculty member. And so I don't think the program has ever really been characterized by what I would call strong leadership, and I think a lot of that simply has to do with the way we structured the leadership function in the first place.
Can you talk a little bit about efforts that were made over the years to get either departmental status or tenure granting authority for the Institute so it would have some of those things that you just talked about?
Yeah. My memory is a little weak on some of that, but I think the most important thing, looking back, is the fact that we talked a number of different times in a number of different years about trying to create a new institutional arrangement for the Institute. That could be affiliation with something such as the School of Business or the Law School. It could have been having industrial relations become a freestanding department within the College of Letters and Science, and therefore be able to grant tenure.
And
you know, various ways of somehow trying to make the program something other than this just kind of free-floating entity that it was. And in most of those discussions until relatively recently in the history of the program, it was always decided that the strength of the program was in fact its independence, and that if we compromised its independence, we would compromise the integrity of the program as we knew it and liked it. And so, but that was always a contentious debate, and not all people saw it that way, but from a voting perspective, the people who basically favored the maintenance of the status quo for the Institute won the vote. And so for a long time, we simply decided to do what we were continuing to do.
So this wasn't just an instance of the university or the college saying, no, we're not going to give you that authority, or it was IR faculty themselves who were saying, we don't want that. We want to remain an independent interdisciplinary institute.
Yeah, but I think those decisions about wanting to remain independent were done without any necessary prompting by the College of Letters and Science. They just were outgrowths of discussions that the faculty had and that the director would bring to the attention of the faculty and say, we should probably talk about this again and see where we stand. It wasn't until fairly recently when we really sought to create a firmer institutional arrangement for the Institute that I think the College of Letters and Science really sort of raised up and started getting involved in the kinds of decision-making processes that we were going through.
Can you talk a bit about your tenure as director in 2000 and 2001, and what sorts of what you saw your mission as, and what kinds of projects you undertook to keep the Institute going?
Well, I reluctantly agreed to be the director, unbeknownst to other people. I had pretty much decided to retire in 2001, and I didn't want to really spend my last year on the faculty being a director, but that's what I ended up doing. And it was out of a extreme sense of loyalty to the IR program and a real sense of gratitude for all that I had derived from it for many years. When I agreed to be the assistant or the acting director, it was also understood that we would be in the process of trying to recruit a new full-time director for the program. And so I viewed my role as one of, one, maintaining the program, and two, trying to undertake a set of activities that would basically remove some administrative headaches that a new director would have, both as a way of making the...
Okay,
so to help out the new director, whoever that was when the director came on board. And so a lot of what I did was basically try to undo what I thought was some of the sort of poor attention to administration by some of the previous directors, and also undertake some positive initiatives to, in particular, stimulate student and new faculty interest in the affairs of the Institute. And I have to say that even though I'm being interviewed by one of the people who is very instrumental in all of that, this is not self-serving in any way. Charlotte was just a gold mine for me in terms of working with me and helping do what we collectively decided thought needed to be done in order to improve the functioning of the Institute and make it a more attractive place for somebody to come.
Thank you.
So, you know, part of it was just things like cleaning out old files and straightening up records and working on the website. We had just embarked on developing a website. It was kind of a mess, and so we tried to clean that up and make it an improved product. Part of it was trying to reach out to newer faculty members around campus and meet with them and talk to them about the Institute, explain what the Institute was all about, and invite them to become participants as participating faculty in the Institute, and to meet their colleagues around campus. In addition, we undertook some initiatives to think about a more formal recruitment program for acquiring new students into the program. Our student numbers had been declining for some time. There were a lot of probable reasons for that, including a lack of financial resources that we were able to offer to students, and the fact that other universities had become much more financially flush in their IR programs and able to sort of buy their students. Minnesota and Illinois in particular were major competitors for us. And so we thought that even though we didn't have the dollars, we had some unique features of the IR program that were worth selling and might be interesting to students. We also decided that we had a lot of people that we could recruit in state, both from the Madison campus and other campuses, in which if they came here they would only have to pay in-state tuition, which in a way would really lessen the financial burden of obtaining a master's or a PhD degree. And so we sort of fashioned a strategy of trying to embark on recruitment trips particularly on the Madison campus, as a way of introducing the program to students who may not have heard of it, and talk about not only the program, but the success of its graduates, and really make students think about IR as a place that might be an attractive place to obtain a master's degree. And so, as I recall, we visited, Charlotte and I visited, we put together a little program, and then visited various places on campus, making presentations to students about the program, and then inviting them to feel free to come and see us in more detail if they had an interest. And as I recall, we actually were able to get several new students from that experience. I don't think it ever was replicated later on, but it was one very, I think, positive attempt that we made to sort of beef up the numbers again and get the enrollment turned around for the Institute.
As I recall, you also started a student financial aid committee.
Yes, we, thanks for reminding me of that. I forgot all about that. We also knew that since financial aid had been dwindling for our students, we should probably take a look at what were the actual sources of financial aid for our current students, and then identify if there were gaps in financial aid that we might be able to fill. And then the second part was to identify where around campus our students were getting funding and where we might seek additional funding for our students. And we thought that was an immediate problem, and also a problem that anybody who is going to be the new director would encounter. So we established a separate financial aid committee, something that, as I recall, the Institute had never had before, simply to address the issues that I just mentioned and make a report to the director. We interestingly found out that things weren't quite as bad on the financial aid front as we had first thought. Our students were getting financial aid from a wide variety of sources. Sometimes the level of support was not very high, which was a problem. And for many of the students who came from out of state, which is one of our strengths as a institute, they did not receive an out-of-state tuition remission or tuition waiver. And so even though they were getting financial aid, they were still confronted with paying very large sums of out-of-state tuition. So we tried to undertake some things that would sort of lessen the financial burden for our current students as well as future students.
My sense is that part of the reason a lot of attention had not been paid to external sources of financial aid in the past was exactly what you said about the Institute's desire to remain independent, and I think there was perhaps a sense on the part of some faculty members that if we had money from corporations or from labor unions, that it would somehow compromise the integrity of the program, or we might be asked to teach courses in a particular way, or have certain content in the courses or something, that those outside organizations would feel as though they had some leverage.
I think that's maybe true, but I don't think that was a very substantial contributor to our financial aid crisis. I think the bigger problem was that with part-time directors who were busy doing many things, they simply did not devote time and energy to financial aid matters for our students. We tried to sort of live on our laurels, if you will. And we came, you know, it caught up with us. But the other thing that was going on is that some historical sources of quite a bit of financial aid began to dry up. And I would point to my own Department of Management and Human Resources as a good example. The faculty were almost all participating members of the Institute, and not only strong supporters of the program, but financially strong supporters of many students, particularly at the doctoral level. But we as a department had made a very conscious decision to beef up our own doctoral programs. And so the money that we had available for supporting doctoral students now got shifted from supporting industrial relations students to supporting students who were coming into our own department from other sources. And we simply were unable to provide the level of support to IR that we once had. And that continues to this day.
One other initiative I recall that you undertook was the cluster hire proposal when you were director. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. The cluster hire proposals involved us teaming with members of other academic units to create a proposition for hiring 3 to 4 faculty members across disciplines focused on a particular interdisciplinary program that simply could not be handled within the confines of a traditional academic department, or as the university liked to refer to them as academic silos. And so we developed, I believe, were participants in the development of 2 different cluster hire proposals for obtaining new faculty who would come into the Institute as part of the cluster hire arrangement, and would hopefully have an academic home within industrial relations, which might also entail being able to acquire tenure within industrial relations. But even if that wasn't the case, being assigned to an academic home, tenure home, where though they would though still maintain a strong interest in industrial relations and be a source of new strength for the program.
And there were, as I recall, probably a couple hundred of those cluster hire proposals, and 4 of them were ultimately chosen by the chancellor.
I think it was more than 4. I'd have to go back and look at all the numbers of cluster hire proposals that were supported. It was a fairly large number, but there were several, as I recall, several waves of calls for proposals as well. It wasn't a one-shot deal. And the cluster hire program continues to today. So I think in total, I may have read somewhere not too recently that, or fairly recently, that there's been a very large number of new faculty hired under the cluster proposal arrangements. Something like 200 or 300 people.
Wow.
I may be wrong on that, but...
But we didn't get one.
We didn't get one. That's sort of the bottom line.
And the other effort I recall that you spearheaded was an attempt to get tenure granting authority for the Institute, and this may have been in connection with recruiting a new director.
Yes, the two were directly linked to each other. The year I became the acting director, John Witte from the La Follette Institute was working very closely with me, because the La Follette Institute at one time had been like industrial relations, a freestanding program without tenure granting authority that had fairly recently actually acquired tenure granting authority and departmental status from the College of Letters and Science. And so I was able to examine the documents that John had used for putting together the case for tenure granting authority and departmental status for the La Follette Institute as a way of sort of guiding our attempts at trying to get tenure granting authority for the Institute. The associate dean in the College of Letters and Science was Mary Ann Fitzpatrick, and she was very supportive of us as we sort of marched down that path. And Mary Ann was also directly involved in approving a search for a new director, and putting together the hiring package that we would be able to offer to the new director. And that package included a couple of new hires, joint hires for industrial relations. So circumstances were very ripe, if you will, for getting a new director and for the first time having tenure granting authority for the Institute.
And then what happened?
Well, what happened was things sort of got bogged down. The biggest thing is that we, the search and screen committee had found what we thought was the ideal candidate. Professor Morris Kleiner from the University of Minnesota. Morris had a joint appointment in industrial relations and in the Humphrey Institute of Public Affairs. And he became our prime candidate. We decided to make him the offer, which was a very generous offer, not only financially, but in terms of the new promises for the Institute, including the hiring of additional faculty. And Morris was virtually certain of accepting the offer, which had been extended to him, when for personal reasons at the last moment he had to withdraw. And that was right at the end of the school year, and so we did not have an opportunity to get back into the market and search again that particular year. That was the year 2001, and so things sort of got pushed off for another year. And at that point I exited, and John Witte then became the acting director of the Institute after me.
And I think in another interview, John has talked about what he did that year and mm-hmm. and a subsequent inability to get a new director.
Right.
So there were really Herculean efforts made on the part of many people to try and keep the Institute going. Can you think of anything that wasn't done that perhaps should have been done to keep the place alive?
Not in any immediate sense. I thought that the College of Letters and Science was, especially with Mary Ann, very receptive to trying to keep us going, not just going, but to re-energize the Institute and rebuild it. And we tried, and it didn't work. I think the things that we tried were appropriate. I thought they were necessary. And I thought they were attractive. We simply could not find many identifiable candidates for the director's job, even under those circumstances. And the momentum that we had there for a while in terms of rebuilding sort of dissipated. And that was certainly not through a lack of effort on our part, mm-hmm. Or John Witte's part or anybody else. Things just didn't quite work. And Then the budget crunch hit the university big time, and...
This was spring of 2002,
yeah,
I believe?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. And all of a sudden, we were very, very vulnerable. And I think another thing that happened was that there wasn't a groundswell of support. Support isn't even the right word. Enthusiasm from among the faculty for renewing the institute. Certainly, people would have liked to have seen it happen, but sort of the intense commitment that we saw in previous years, it sort of withered. We didn't have as many participating faculty. Many of the people who had been the staunchest allies of the Institute were no longer with us. And many of the newer faculty that I tried to reach out to were new faculty, and they just didn't have a sense of a necessity or desirability to come in and really become active participants and supporters of the Institute. And so just kind of a gradual waning in the active support that we saw over time.
The folks in South Hall were all the same. Marianne was still there, Phil Certain was still there. And they had, at least you said, Marianne was very supportive of IR efforts for
mm-hmm.
tenure granting authority and recruiting new faculty and so on. What, you know, why all of a sudden, a year later, a decision to close the Institute?
Well, actually, I think it was 2 years later.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have to remember there was a second failed attempt to obtain a new director. We made a second offer to Adrian Eaton at Rutgers, and that, for a number of reasons, fizzled as well. And I don't know, but I imagine the view from College of Letters and Science was, well, we've kind of gone the extra mile here. Things have not worked. And things had very much changed for the college, too, in the sense that they were under incredible budget constraints and were looking anywhere for places to save money. And it wasn't a hollow academic exercise. It was very real. They had big budget shortfalls. They needed to find money where they could. And I think that's just the way it unfolded.
And there was not enough of a lobby on the part of interested faculty or alumni or students to make them rethink that decision?
I think that's true. But lobbying is probably a good word for it. And I'm not sure even if there had been a massive lobbying effort, it would have made a difference. I don't know, but that's a speculation on my part.
I just wondered because another person whom I interviewed said that the college seemed to be trying to get rid of all these little interdisciplinary programs that were popping up, and in the case of some of those programs, there was a lot of there were a lot of people who were concerned that they keep going. For instance, women's studies had buy-in from faculty all over campus.
Right.
Afro-American yeah. studies did get departmental status, and there weren't enough people all over the place, and it wasn't maybe enough of a politically correct thing, you know. IR didn't have the cachet or whatever to make it important to hang on to.
Yeah, I think that there's probably some truth to that. I think the biggest reflection of that was the sort of waning faculty support. Mm-hmm. My own sense is that if we'd have had not had that waning faculty support, but we'd had continuing faculty support, with much more enthusiasm over the years and so on, we would have had a better chance of success. Mm-hmm. But we just didn't.
One of the efforts I know that was made toward the very end, after LNS decided to close the Institute, there was an effort made to move it to the School of Business. Were you part of those discussions?
No, I wasn't. Okay. I was, at that time, I'd been retired for 2 years, and so I didn't partake in any discussions at all. Not even a part of the School of Business, technically. Well, actually I am, but not a member of the Management and Human Resources Department.
That effort didn't go any place either.
Which doesn't surprise me. The stars just weren't aligned at some point, and things just were not going to happen.
I don't have any other questions, but is there anything else that you'd like to say about the Institute or anybody who's listening to this tape down the road that you would want them to know?
I guess the thing that stands out in my mind after all these years of association with the Institute was what a marvelous place it was. For both faculty and students, to me, it was a very unique experience that we could gather, both faculty and students, and it wasn't replicable on campus, so it became a very special place for a lot of us, and both students and faculty, and I think the loyalty of our alumni over the years to the program and their intense feelings about the times that they had here are more than adequate testimony to just the fervor in which we have held this place over the years. And it's a shame that things came to an end. But on the other hand, maybe others can learn from us in trying to replicate some of the things that we did for very successfully for a long time to create a very unique educational experience for people and incorporate that into their own interdisciplinary programs as they invariably will well forth within the university. And if they can do that, then they will have a good chance of success. Maybe not permanent success, but success for a pretty long period of time. We're going to have a good run at it.
Well, this place is just about 60 years old, so that's
yeah, yeah.
That's a good one.
Yeah. Other than that, nothing really. I mean, I'm just very sad about what happened. As I say, at some point it seems like the stars kind of became aligned and things became inevitable, and that's just the way it was.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.